prevents a national disaster.
The digital station for comedy, drama and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, it's part two of Jane's Fame by Claire Harmon, which charts the story of Jane Austen's rise from humble family scribblings to Hollywood films. The last years of Jane Austen's life were a period of concentrated writing and business with publishers. Though largely cut off from the fashionable literary world, her fame was nonetheless beginning to spread. The reader is Alice Krieger.
In his memoir of Jane Austen, James Edward Austen Leigh said of his aunt, "I do not think that she was herself much mortified by the want of early success. She wrote for her own amusement. Money, though acceptable, was not necessary for the moderate expenses of her quiet home." This is a remarkably inaccurate view of Austen. She was mortified by the humiliating rejections and delays she faced in the first half of her career, did want to make money, and had no intention of writing for her own amusement alone. She wanted lots of readers, and "though I like praise as well as anybody," she wrote in 1814 with bracing directness, "I like what Edward calls pewter, too." The most persistent theory about Austen's life is that she had two phases of composition, divided by 8 years of silence when the family moved to Bath in 1801. She left no diaries and very few letters from these years, so they are indeed difficult to reconstruct. But while it is impossible to quantify the extent of Austen's writing activity and business with publishers during this time, there is no reason to suppose she didn't have any. The move to Bath gave excellent access to booksellers, circulating libraries, and the general gossip about books. The Austens would have felt far better connected with the world of books than in rural Hampshire. It was through a bookseller in Bath that Jane had her first contact with the publisher Crosby, to whom she sold the manuscript of her Gothic satire Susan, later Northanger Abbey, for £10 outright. For 27-year-old Austen and her family, this must have been an intensely exciting time. Crosby's acceptance crowned a decade of effort and came at a very significant moment in her life. A few months earlier, she had received a proposal of marriage from Harris Bigwither, heir to a splendid family home, Manydown, near Basingstoke. It's usually assumed that this offer came out of the blue, but without any letters, it's impossible to tell how intimately acquainted they were. The fact that Jane accepted his proposal, even though she withdrew her acceptance within hours and fled from Manydown, indicates that she had already considered marrying him. Whatever the circumstances, this was a turning point in her life. In December 1802, Austen teetered on the edge of becoming the mistress of a beautiful estate and the mother of lots of little Bigwithers. By the spring of 1803, she was a free woman and about to be a published writer. When her father died in 1805, aged 73, Jane lost the best supporter of her literary endeavours. The Austen women were now heavily dependent on the charity of the remaining Austen men. Jane's new situation, as an unmarried, unprotected, and now virtually penniless 29-year-old, was borne in on her forcefully as she, her sister and widowed mother moved around a series of rented houses during the next 4 years. While it was clearly a time of change, she is unlikely to have given up her habit of writing. It's as unlikely as her not having written any letters in the same period. We just don't have the documentation anymore. Perseverance was a quality Austen possessed almost to the point of bloody-mindedness. She needed a powerful work ethic to see her through years of writing, revising and adapting a growing collection of unpublished works. Hardly any of the original manuscripts have survived, so it is difficult to reconstruct her working methods. The 6 major novels only exist as finished items, as if they really had been produced effortlessly. But from the year she did first get published to her death in 1817, her output had a production line efficiency. By 1810, Sense and Sensibility, rewritten at least twice, was ready to be sent out, and she began immediately on a new novel. Known later as Mansfield Park, it was finished within 2 years and 4 months, the first book not to be composed in fits and starts over a much longer period. She must also have been working on the revision of First Impressions into Pride and Prejudice, since it was lined up and ready to be offered to the publisher after the publication of Sense and Sensibility. And from what she later said of having lopped and cropped it extensively, the work of revision took time. Austen's method of revising was to pin slips of paper over sections of text to be amended, where there isn't room simply to write above the line, a 19th century version of cut and paste. Her use of dressmaking pins to attach corrections is a nice connection between her writing life and her domestic life. The circle of people who knew about Jane's authorship was small up to this point, and of all the nieces and nephews, only Fanny was in on the secret. Cassandra wrote more than once, "To beg we should not mention that Aunt Jane Austen wrote Sense and Sensibility." In truth, there wasn't much need to worry about secrecy. The author must sometimes have hankered for less of it, and probably didn't even know the momentous date on which the novel was eventually published. News of its reception in the wider world filtered through to Chawton Cottage only slowly. Unknown to her, the novel was generating plenty of interest, especially in the fashionable world. There was gossip about who the author of this charming book might be. Edgerton, the publisher, had transposed "by a lady" in one advertisement as "by Lady A." Typo or sales stratagem is hard to know. This sort of literary guessing game was a popular pastime in an age where anonymity was standard practice. As Austen's friend Mrs. Pole later remarked of the novels, "everybody was desirous to attribute them to some of their own friends, or to some person of whom they thought highly." For Austen, anonymous and uninformed in her Hampshire village, the sense of being a published author remained rather abstract. She was best able to measure her success through the book's sales. By July 1813, the first edition of around 750 copies had sold out, earning a profit of £140. This was a very respectable sum, though nothing compared to the record-breaking deal Fanny Burney was about to sign, an advance of £3,000 that made even Byron's eyes water. Edgerton was interested in publishing more, and she had Mansfield Park underway and Pride and Prejudice ready for the press. "I want to tell you that I have got my own darling child from London," Jane wrote triumphantly to her sister in 1813, when the first set of Pride and Prejudice arrived at Chawton. "On Wednesday, I received one copy. The advertisement is in our paper today for the first time. 18 shillings. Austen had little idea how much impression Pride and Prejudice had made on its first readers. At a dinner party in the year of publication, the playwright Sheridan urged a Miss Sheriff to buy it immediately, for it was one of the cleverest things subsequently he ever read. She took the great man's advice and became such an admirer of Austen's work that she used to hope for a carriage breakdown every time she passed through Chawton in order to contrive acquaintance with the authoress. Miss Sheriff was Austen's first obsessive fan. Another early reader, Miss Milbank, wrote that she felt the interest is very strong, especially for Mr. Darcy. This is, I believe, the first recorded instance of a condition which has gripped millions of others since, Darcy philia. Austen's astonishingly powerful creation of the supreme bourgeois fantasy man, aristocratic, handsome, heterosexual, and possessed of Pemberley, rather gave the lie to the novel's ostensible anti-romanticism. Miss Milbank, who the very next year was courted by and accepted England's most wanted bachelor, Lord Byron, must have appreciated this at many levels. Austen now thought of herself as a full-time novelist, and the 5 years from 1811 to 1816 were an almost constant round of writing, revising, correcting proofs, and getting published. An interesting view of how fame affected her, in the few years she was granted it, comes from the writer Mary Russell Mitford. "A friend of mine says that she has stiffened into the most perpendicular, precise, taciturn piece of single blessedness that ever existed, and that, till Pride and Prejudice showed what a precious gem was hidden in that unbending case, she was no more regarded in society than a poker or a fire screen, or any other thin, upright piece of wood or iron that fills its corner in peace and quietness. The case is very different now. She is still a poker, but a poker of whom everyone is afraid. It must be confessed that this silent observation from such an observer is rather formidable. A wit, a delineator of character, who does not talk, is terrific indeed. The Prince Regent was a great admirer of the novels, and kept a set in each of his residences. Few people could have been less flattered by this. Jane thoroughly disapproved of him, and had sided strongly with his wife during their scandalous public wrangling at the time of the divorce proceedings. But then she received an invitation to visit his library at Carlton House and be received by the librarian, the Reverend James Stanier Clark. This questionable treat took place on November the 13th, 1815. Jane was given a tour of the ornate and garishly coloured palace, stuffed with gilt and ormolu and velvet hangings, and in the Gothic library Mr. Clark passed on the Prince's permission, which she had never sought, of course, to dedicate her next book to him. Such an offer was tantamount to a command and caused Austen some anxiety about protocol. In the meantime, Mr. Clark had begun to pester her with suggestions for future subjects. Something about a clergyman, perhaps, who is fond of literature and is, indeed, rather like himself. The surviving correspondence gives us a glimpse of what she had to put up with as a woman of extraordinary talent being patronised by nincompoops. Clark insisted that his rooms in Golden Square, my cell, where I often hide myself, were ever at her disposal. Perhaps the Reverend Clark, who has gone down in literary history as one of the great fools, was a little in love with the creator of Emma Woodhouse and Elizabeth Bennet. And who can blame him? By the middle of 1816, Jane Austen was suffering from pains in the back and chronic fatigue. On a summer visit, her hosts noticed how ill she looked and were struck by her peculiar manner, as if she did not expect to see them again. By the time Jane made up the booklets in which she began her next novel, later entitled Sanditon, she had been ill for some months, though hopeful of a recovery. She wrote about 24,000 words before putting the story aside in March 1817. In June, Austen was moved to lodgings in Winchester to be near her doctor. It is not certain what was wrong with her. Bright's disease, Addison's disease, or cancer are the more recent suggestions. Her symptoms were of severe debilitation, discoloured skin, pains. Usually when she was going away from home, Austen would have taken work to do, but not this time. The prognosis was bad, and whether Jane had been told it or not, her brother believed she was well aware of her situation. The family hung on every sign of a rally, and the patient herself remained composed and cheerful. She became so weak that she was only able to totter around the rooms in College Street. For excursions, she was taken out in a sedan chair. When she had the strength, she wrote letters or dictated them, and on the 15th of July composed some verses on the subject of Winchester races. The speaker is St. Swithin. O subjects rebellious, O venter depraved, when once we are buried you think we are gone, but behold me immortal. These unexceptional comic verses were the last thing Jane Austen ever wrote. 2 days after composing them, she was dead.
Alice Krieger reading Jane's Fame by Claire Harmon. It was abridged by Polly Coles and produced by Clive Brill. It was a Pacificus production for the BBC. And tomorrow we'll learn how interest in Jane Austen was beginning to wane in the 19th century until the first biography was published in 1870.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock now. Patrick O'Brien's naval epic, The Mauritius Command, continues next. Later, Bill Bailey investigates... Hang on, hold the music. Now listen to that. Can you hear that? He investigates the low-frequency sounds that pervade our lives and drive us mad. The Hunt for the Hum is at 8:30. And Alex Horn and his band are back for a new series later in the Comedy Club at 10. But now it's part two of The Mauritius Command, set in the early years of the 19th century and starring David Robb as Captain Jack Aubrey and Richard Delane as the naval surgeon and spy Stephen Maturin. As Aubrey prepares to lead his small flotilla of Royal Navy ships against French forces in the Indian Ocean, he wrestles with the problem of how to deal with the captains under his command, in particular the dashing Lord Clonfort, who had once been his superior officer.
When we make a cable's length from the privateer, then we go at him.
She is quiet, sir.
We shall be first aboard, Mr. Cotton, at this rate. Clonfort's boats are still behind that spit of land.
That is 300 yards now, I think, sir.
Very well, then. Good luck to you, Cotton.
And to you, Aubrey.
Now, men, raise a cheer and stretch out like good uns!
The Mauritius Command by Patrick O'Brien. Dramatized in three parts by Roger Daines. Episode 2.
Keep ahead right at them. Clonfort's boats are taking the larboard. Press hard, boys!
I hear them cheer, but I don't see them, sir.
Here's the smoke. They're coming on, make no doubt of it. Ready the grapples! Axes!
They're cheering, but I don't think they're moving.
Clonfort cannot look on. He must attack.
I don't believe he intends to stir.
Too late now for us to do anything other than race on. On then! Never mind the great Agamemnon's forever!
Keep together!
Precious hot work, Mr. Cotton! Mate!
They're beginning to fall back, sir.
Bucken! Tweet Scaramanus to the quota halyards! As soon as... Cotton! Cotton! Oh, God! God!
An able, dashing man, then? The Lord Clonfort?
Oh, the Agamemnon was a crowded wardroom. She wearing the flag. The West Indies station is a busy one still.
I'm perfectly aware, Jack, of your dislike of saying anything unpleasant of a former shipmate, even though you now have to rely upon him as a subordinate captain.
It was 10 years ago, Stephen. I hardly knew Clonfort then.
You will permit me to say that although I honour your principle in theory, I find it somewhat irritating, having, as it may, a detrimental effect upon our business of sweeping this French squadron from the Indian Ocean.
Lord Clonfort has made quite a reputation for himself since our West Indies days.
Did you take the privateer, sir?
Of course. The French captain flung his empty pistols at my head and swam for it, followed by most of his remaining men. Luck never deserted me in those days, Stephen.
Man might esteem himself better served by luck had he been supported by his fellow lieutenant and the other boat.
It was a cruel, bitter little action. I've seen many such since. And afterward, Clonfort explained it all.
I was right up against a sandbank, Aubrey. The North Channel proved much more shallow than we had hoped. We found ourselves quickly pinned down by their shore battery.
Cotton said you weren't moving.
Cotton is dead.
Oh.
You made the most gallant dash, Aubrey. I was in the very act of landing to take the battery from behind when you made your run in. Gallant. Dashing. You must know it would have been suicide, though, for me to have moved.
It did all seem very uninteresting and unimportant.